From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is James Lindsay. He's co-author of the recently published book, The Empty Throne, America's Abdication of Global Leadership. The book is a powerful review and critique of U.S. President Donald J. Trump's conduct of foreign policy. James Lindsay is Senior Vice President, Director of Studies, and the Morris R. Greenberg Chair at the Council on Foreign Relations. That's a distinguished nationwide policy group with offices in New York and Washington. Before he joined CFR in 2009, Lindsay was the director of the Center for International Security and Law at the University of Texas in Austin. In the book, The Empty Throne, Lindsay and co-author Ivo Dalder, former ambassador to NATO, argue that the three pillars of the post-war foreign policy that America created, strong alliances, open markets, and commitment to democracy and human rights, are under threat from President Donald Trump. According to the authors, Trump didn't see global leadership as the solution to what ailed America. To the contrary, he saw it as the problem. Citing the U.S. withdrawal from the Multilateral Trade Agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, the Paris Climate Accords, the Iran nuclear deal, as well as the imposition of tariffs on allies and rivals alike, Lindsay and Dalder argue that the Trump administration's so-called America First foreign policy renders America increasingly alone and isolated on the world stage. They caution that allies may look elsewhere for leadership in America's absence, and rivals such as China are ready and willing to fill the void. While time is short, the authors conclude opportunities still exist to revive American leadership. And James Lindsay joins us here at the VOA broadcast studio in Washington to discuss The Empty Throne. James, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Carol.
For those of us who are following foreign policy, it serves as a great summary. And for those who don't, it's an excellent primer. What prompted you to publish the book now? What was the impetus and the purpose?
Well, Carol, we wrote the book because we wanted people to understand the fundamental changes that President Trump is making to American foreign policy and also why they matter. A lot of media coverage of President Trump tends to focus on his unusual behavior, how he's violating traditional protocols and norms. But what that coverage tends to miss is the particular worldview President Trump brings to foreign policy. It's a worldview he's held all of his adult life. It is a different view of how the United States should operate around the world, and it is a coherent worldview that needs to be taken seriously.
So let's take a look at the immediate and the long-term repercussions of Trump's rejection of those three pillars that I mentioned in the introduction. Those three pillars that have undergirded U.S. foreign policy for decades, i.e. security alliances, free trade, and values of democracy and human rights, all of which are premised on a rules-based order. Talk about the repercussions of having abandoned, at least temporarily, these pillars.
Well, when you look at it, from President Trump's point of view, American leadership, as you note, isn't the solution to what ails America. It's the cause of what ails America. You might remember when he gave his inaugural address, he talked about America's carnage. And he laid America's carnage at the feet of alliances that had the United States protecting its friends while those friends used their multilateral agreements to steal jobs from the United States. Now, I would disagree significantly with the president on his diagnosis for America's domestic ills, but it is clear he has proceeded from this belief that he needs to treat America's friends, not as friends and allies, as trusted partners, but to borrow a word he's used more than once, as foes who must be beaten. And so we've seen a shift in how American foreign policy operates from focus on leadership to focusing on beating or winning. Now, keep in mind, leadership is, as my good friend and colleague Gideon Rose, the editor of Foreign Affairs, likes to say, something you do with people. Beating is something you do to people. And I think one of the things you're seeing around the world on issues ranging from security issues to trade issues to issues of human rights that America is finding itself estranged from many of its allies. This is true whether you go to Asia, go to Europe, or go to South America.
Let's look at this so-called America First doctrine. Many have criticized this phrase. This phrase harks back to World War II when an influential political pressure group, they opposed direct military involvement. Nonetheless, Nobody is disputing the importance of placing America first. I think every country would put its sovereign interests first. So why do you think Mr. Trump sees some kind of a contradiction in being part of alliances and multilateral institutions and still being able to put the interests of our country first? Because we're seeing some consequences now, for example, with trade, withdrawing from the TPP or placing tariffs on some of our allies with respect to aluminum and steel. It's actually hurting the very industries or people that Mr. Trump purports to want to protect.
It's a great question, Carol. Maybe I could sort of attack it both at a broad level and then a specific example. The broad level is, you're quite right, the issue here isn't one about whether or not the United States should pursue its interests. The United States has always pursued its interests. The question is, what is the best way to pursue those interests and also America's values? And I would note that the tradition that President Trump is turning his back on is a tradition that's been around for 70 years, and it was forged in the furnace of World War II. When you go back to the Greatest Generation or the wise men, as they stood sort of surveying the world in the mid-1940s, they were shaped by their historical experience. And their historical experience was that the United States had been told it could avoid the Great War, World War I. It turned out it couldn't. It went into that war. Then it came home. It rejected the Treaty of Versailles, and it fell prey to the original America First, which said that the United States, if it stayed at home in Fortress America, could remain safe and secure. That belief, that vision, that myth died on December 7th, 1941 with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. So for FDR, for Harry Truman, for General George C. Marshall, Dean Acheson, sort of the heavyweights of American foreign policy, they were faced with the victory in World War II with the question of what kind of order do they want to create? And the order they sought to create after World War II put more of an emphasis on cooperation and coordination. The idea was that if the United States could create an order in which other countries could benefit, the United States would as well. That geopolitical innovation, and it was truly unique, there was nothing like it in world history, succeeded immensely. It put Europe back on its feet. It won the Cold War. But President Trump has for decades now argued that it was that order that actually impoverished the United States. So he wants to return in some sense to an older vision of foreign policy, one that emphasizes power, acting unilaterally, dealing with countries one-on-one. It's built with a heavy skepticism of this order and what it produces. And I would argue that the president's return to what we call domination politics, the strong do as they will, the weak suffer as we must, returns us or threatens to return us to the world that the Greatest Generation tried to get us out of. Let me just give you one example in terms of how this works. The president, third day in office, pulls the United States out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP. This is this big trade deal involving 12 Pacific Rim countries that was designed partly for its economic impact to open up markets to American products, but also as a counterweight to China. The president left the TPP without any strategic review as to the consequences or without any alternative to offer. And what is striking as a result is the president thought that TPP would fall apart. It didn't. Our friends and allies preserved and kept the deal alive. It's actually going to go into effect now in a reduced size later on this year. And then they proceeded to go on and strike trade deals among themselves, oftentimes leaving the United States and U.S. producers by the wayside. I'll just give you one example. Japan, which is part of the TPP, negotiated a free trade agreement with Europe. And whereas in January of 2017, Iowa pork farmers thought they were going to get to be able to sell their pork into the Japanese market at a discount to their competitors, President Trump ripped up TPP. That went away. The Japanese struck a trade deal with the Europeans. Now it's European pork products that get into the Japanese market at a much lower price and have a competitive advantage. American pork producers are losers in that transaction. And we can multiply this over and over across trade deals in a variety of other foreign policy areas.
Indeed, and that renders the so-called America First doctrine somewhat of a paradox, because the very policies that flow from it hurt the very people Mr. Trump would like to protect, or industries, it seems.
Oh, very much so. And I think I take as sincere the president's desire to want to create jobs in the United States, to address the concerns of Americans who felt they had been left behind by globalization. I take those as genuine. The issue here isn't about whether we're addressing the correct problems. The question is, do you have the correct prescriptions? And I think on that front, the answer is no. And I'll give you another example. The president has pursued a policy slapping tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from other countries. They have retaliated. One of the victims of that retaliation has been Maine lobstermen. Turns out now, since Canada now has a free trade agreement with Europe, that Canadian lobsters get to go into Europe tariff-free. American lobsters face an 8% tariff or tax. And as you might imagine, if you're a European consumer, you'd rather buy Canadian lobsters with no tax rather than American lobsters that come with a tax. So people get hurt by these policies that on one level sound very appealing and maybe motivated by the best of intentions, but actually end up hurting the people they're supposed to protect.
Some of Mr. Trump's critiques about our stalwart allies, the Atlantic Alliance, for example, certainly do echo some truth. Even President Obama criticized some of the NATO allies for not doing their share, but over the past years, they have been doing much more to protect our collective security. So what worries some people is that some of Mr. Trump's critiques don't really ring true, so that this is a myth that maybe NATO members aren't paying their fair share. So this also is problematic.
Well, there are two important points to make here. One is that President Trump, when he came to office, said time and again, I inherited a mess. And I have great sympathy for his feeling that way because he did inherit a lot of problems. And the rules-based order or the liberal international order that had been driven by American power and leadership for seven decades, there were legitimate complaints that could be made about America's friends and allies not spending enough, for example, on NATO. But also that there's been progress toward doing that. Since 2014, the NATO members have been pledged to bring their spending on defense up to 2% of their gross domestic product. Five of them are now there. And we're in a reasonable trend line to get to all of them by the due date of 2024. And one of the problems that is with the president continually attacking our friends and allies by calling them foes, he is actually making it harder politically for governments in those countries to spend more on defense, for example, because the president himself becomes unpopular. Every country has its own domestic politics. And so you go to a variety of countries in Europe, they all of a sudden turn it from not the question of should we keep up our pledge that we made at the NATO summit in 2014, but why should we do what Donald Trump says we should do, given that our constituents don't like President Trump?
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is James Lindsay. He's co-author of the new book, The Empty Throne, America's Abdication of Global Leadership. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find that download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal radio and Facebook fan, Chidi Goodness from Lagos, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, James Lindsay, co-author of The Empty Throne. Well, James, let's talk about Mr. Trump's curious embrace of autocrats and despots. Now, nobody is saying that our allies are perfect. You just said before the break, they have many shortcomings. But by and large, we share values, we share interests, and perhaps they are not deserving of some of the criticism that President Trump lobs against them. And in fact, it backfires on us. But why do you think he goes, 360 degrees in the other direction to embrace, autocrats? And I'm, of course, referring to Vladimir Putin of Russia, who upended the post-World War II order by invading a sovereign country, Eastern Ukraine, annexing Crimea, just for one example.
Well, the president has long expressed admiration for strongmen and autocrats. I'll leave it to others to decipher the motivation or the psychology of that. But it's also tied to a deep-seated belief that the president has aired for years now that the United States shouldn't be in the business of worrying about human rights in democracy promotion. He has, in essence, argued, and he argued this repeatedly over the course of the 2016 presidential campaign, that we should fix our problems at home first. And one of the important consequences of the president's approach to these issues, not making and actually sidelining democracy promotion, rule of law and human rights in American foreign policy, is it actually empowers and emboldens leaders that are hostile to American values. And anyone who studies foreign policy knows that at times, interests and values that can come into conflict. That is not something new. But presidents have generally tried to find ways to reconcile or shrink the difference there. And I think the president probably is perhaps most notable in the dealings with Saudi Arabia and the evidence that journalist Jamal Khashoggi was killed at the highest orders of the Saudi government, that by not even accepting the conclusions of U.S. intelligence agencies, the president is actually emboldening bad actors to pursue policies that are harmful to the values that we care about. And it actually has knock-on effects. As autocracy strengthens and grows, there's the potential for democracy to weaken and shrink. We already see it right now. We are really globally in the midst of a democracy recession. Countries that were democratic are becoming less so. Think Turkey. And even countries that are still part of the democratic West are increasingly moving in the direction of what we might call illiberal democracy. Think Hungary, perhaps, is the poster child for that.
And certainly the recent decision with respect to Saudi Arabia is disturbing, because many analysts would argue that while Saudi Arabia is an important security partner, one can still value the country as a security partner, but still punish the kingdom or hold it accountable for this egregious act. And at the same time, while Mr. Trump argues, well, we need Saudi Arabia to help thwart Iran in the region, others would argue and point to evidence that demonstrates that Saudi Arabia's invasion of Yemen, at least the way it prosecuted the war, has actually done more to embolden Iran in the region and throw the Houthi rebels more into their embrace.
The U.S. policy toward the Yemen conflict, which predates President Trump, to be clear, has actually made matters worse rather than address the fundamental concern about Iranian influence in Yemen and elsewhere in the Middle East. But I think as you look at it, the other part of the problem is that by so clearly standing up for the Saudi leadership in the face of clear evidence to the contrary, what the president has done is actually emboldened the Saudis, in essence, making them seem essentially more important. And you're quite right, Carol. It's in these situations, it's seldom the case that it's either or. It is quite possible for the United States both to continue its relationship with Saudi Arabia, but also to criticize Saudi Arabia when it violates policies and precepts that we hold dear. And that's what good statesmanship, good foreign policy leadership does. It tries to reconcile things that may easily fall apart and not get trapped in this sort of simplistic either-or mentality.
All of this reminds me of George W. Bush when we were attacked on 9/11. What happened to the warning that the U.S. is weakened if we do sacrifice our core values of dignity, human rights, for security, or just narrow economic gain? And when I even say economic gain, that reminds me that even President Trump's allegations that we need the Saudis to buy these weapons, even that was exaggerated, because they have not bought these hundreds of billions of dollars of weapon systems. That was a promise, a pledge that hasn't yet come to pass. And the fact that they might go to China or Russia is also very implausible. It's just
correct,
not something that they would do. So this is also important. We have to look at history, and we have to worry about a signal to our allies and adversaries by the Saudi decision. And we look at George W. Bush, who himself said that 60 years of Western nations excusing and accommodating the lack of freedom in the Middle East did nothing to make us safe, because in the long run, stability cannot be purchased at the expense of liberty, unquote.
Correct. And I think this is the downside to the America First policy as pursued by Donald Trump, that the United States does have values that matter, and it's important for the United States to be seen standing up for those values. And it is not to our credit as a nation when we don't stand up for our values. And again, the quote you just gave from President George W. Bush points to reality. And oftentimes the United States looked the other way, came back later on to regret having done so. And again, this is a further example that actually broadens the divisions between us and our allies. You know, we talk about America's role in the world over the last 70 years, and it was never perfect. The United States made lots of misjudgments, pursued policies that it thought would work and didn't. But for the most part, American foreign policy improved the fate of the world and the status of people around the globe. And as we did it, and because we did it, we enjoyed a tremendous amount of goodwill. We were the country that defeated the Nazis. We were the country that stared down the Soviet Union. But the number of people who were born in the shadow of World War II or the shadow of the Cold War is shrinking as a percentage of the overall global population. And as you look around the world, more and more people are of an age, they know America as the country that invaded Iraq, the country that waterboarded prisoners, the country that nearly wrecked the international financial system through its subprime mortgage crisis, that has now turned its back on immigrants and refugees, that refuses to acknowledge that climate change poses an existential threat to all of humanity. And so I worry that down the road, whereas before we could draw on a lot of goodwill, even when we didn't choose wisely as a country, that we will find a lot of people that won't believe us even when we do try to choose wisely.
So let's look forward, because as you noted, democracy seems to be in decline. We're seeing a rise of populism and nationalism, economic nationalism, and many on the left are also frustrated and critical of the preeminence of America on the world stage, questioning perhaps these three pillars that have undergirded U.S. foreign policy. So where do we go from here? What would you prescribe? Should we try to go back to the more traditional foreign policy approach, or is there a third way?
Well, let me suggest, number one, that we have to sort of be aware for the United States and also for many other countries, what is the consequence of letting the so-called rules-based or liberal international order fall by the wayside? I think what it means is you're likely to have a world that is more conflict-prone. It is a world that is going to be less prosperous. It is a world in which democracy and human rights will fare less well. Why do I think that? Because history shows that to be the case. Again, President Trump, in some sense, wants to normalize American foreign policy to be like other countries, as he's put it, to put its narrow self-interest first. We've had millennia of human experience what happens when countries pursue their narrow self-interest. And there's often talk about how we could carve up our spheres of influence. And what we've learned when you have spheres of influence or spheres of interest is that great powers quickly begin to disagree about where their sphere ends and someone else's sphere begins, and you get war. Likewise, if you see countries pursuing more mercantilist economic policies, imposing tariffs, carving up trade blocks, you're going to get less trade, less prosperity. Think about the 1930s. And again, the kind of world the greatest generation in the United States sought to build was shaped by the reality of what they had lived through in the 1920s and the 1930s. Is there an alternative? I will actually give President Trump credit for one very important thing, which is that he has quite emphatically shown America's friends and allies what a world without American leadership looks like. And indeed, one of the reasons that rules-based order was struggling over the last two decades was because on a number of occasions, countries were quite happy to pocket the benefits of the rules-based order, but not really willing to pay for its costs or maintenance. I think that's really changed. And we can see that whether we talk about issues like the Iran nuclear deal, where Britain, France, Germany came forward with a package of policy proposals that tried to address what the Trump administration was seeking to accomplish. We see a lot of countries willing to step up. Again, Ambassador Dalton and I have written a piece that actually calls on countries to do more than wring their hands and mutter about their unhappiness with President Trump, but to do more to sort of sustain this international order on which America's security and prosperity rest, and theirs does as well.
Very well said. And with respect to Iran, many people have criticized the Iran nuclear deal, saying that it fell short, the deal that Mr. Obama helped to engineer. But as you said, many of the allies stepped up and tried to address the very problems that Mr. Trump pointed out, but he was unwilling to go along with that and decided that he would just do the opposite of Mr. Obama and just withdraw from the deal. And we do see a pattern in many of the decisions by the Trump administration. Even though some of the cabinet members weren't in agreement, we know Defense Secretary Mattis was not in favor of withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal, notwithstanding its many shortcomings. You see Mr. Trump oftentimes just wanting to do the antithesis of his predecessor. And that's not really a good way, perhaps one would argue, to conduct foreign policy.
There's a lot there. I would simply point out, when you look at the Iran nuclear deal and you look at a variety of other instances, think, for example, the trade war with China, where a number of America's trading partners have said, we share your concerns about predatory Chinese trade policies. We want to work with you. The administration has essentially said, no thanks, we got it, we don't need the help. And this is, again, ironic when you think of the way President Trump campaigned in 2016. His argument over and over again was, we're in our predicament because our friends and allies didn't do enough, they need to do more. But here we have our friends and allies saying, we're prepared to do more, and the administration's not interested in their help. And that is, in many ways, the central irony of Donald Trump's America First policy.
So going back to Trump foreign policy and to what extent it can be either mitigated or things could go differently in the future, we know that foreign policy is the province of the executive branch. But what about Congress? What role can Congress play, perhaps, in trying to mitigate some of the damage to the U.S. image and its interests?
You're quite right. Congress can certainly be a more vocal participant in U.S. foreign policy. The Constitution of the United States gives Congress considerable foreign policy powers. And here's the rub. Over the years, certainly after World War II, Congress delegated a lot of authority to the president because of the demands of the Cold War, the desire to have the president able to respond quickly to emergencies. And indeed, let's just take the case of trade, where Congress, though it is constitutionally charged with regulating commerce with foreign nations, gave the president a lot of statutory authority. And the president has been using this, President Trump has been using this authority, for example, to impose tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. Those authorities that were delegated, those delegations were quite broad and not very well defined. And this is a president who's more than happy to read in the maximum amount of discretion to what's given him by Congress. So Congress now has a challenge. Well, you're going to have to bring that power back.
We shall see what the Democrats will do with their newly won majority in Congress.
I expect you will see them hold a lot of hearings, and they will try to shine a spotlight on issues that they feel the president has mishandled. So I would imagine you'll see a lot about what the administration has done in terms of responding to the Jamal Khashoggi murder. I would expect them to investigate Russian interference in American and other countries' election. I would imagine them looking very carefully at the immigration policy the United States has monitored or imposed, particularly on America's southern border with Mexico. I would expect them to investigate a whole variety of issues. And the broader question, to what extent the Trump Organization benefits financially from his presidency. So they'll shine a spotlight and have hearings on these and other issues. It's not clear, though, that simply highlighting those issues and putting them in the front pages of newspapers is going to succeed in getting the administration to change its foreign policy. Presidents can make decisions, take steps, and then say, I dare you to stop me. And for a whole variety of reasons, legal reasons, political reasons, Congress can find it very difficult to stop an American president.
And as we close, James Lindsay, is there any way to regain the loss of trust among many of our allies as a result of some of Mr. Trump's decisions?
Oh, I think it's going to be very hard to do because, as people know from their personal lives, trust is very hard to acquire and very easy to lose. Now, I do think the United States has one important thing going for it, which is that its friends and allies, and it has many friends and allies around the world, much more so than China does or that Russia does, is that the appeal of the American vision, of the appeal of what it was the greatest generation produced, creating an order in which other countries could prosper and do well, that power by itself shouldn't determine the outcome of decisions, that view, the soft power of America and what it represents in terms of individual liberty, still is extensive. And if you go around and do public opinion polls, as groups like the Pew Foundation here in the United States has done, what you discover is, while in many countries publics may not have high approval ratings for Donald Trump, they give the idea of a return to American leadership very high marks. That is, people look around and say, if someone's got a lead, I'd much rather be the United States than anyone else.
The book is The Empty Throne, America's Abdication of Global Leadership. The co-author, along with Evo Dalder, is our guest, James Lindsay. James, thank you so much for a terrific conversation.
Thanks for having me on, Carol. Really appreciate it.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.